watched the movies with the kids and made notes about who had pants on and who didn't. Sergeant Simpson was right about Donald Duck not having on pants. Pee-wee got pissed. I think he was really pissed because he thought Simpson was putting down Donald Duck. Halfway through the movies, we heard the sounds of big guns being fired in the distance. Sergeant Simpson said that a lot of it was Kong artillery. It kept up for nearly 3 hours without letting up. There was a lot of air activity, and we actually saw a jet go down. The jet was streaking across the sky, and then we saw a rocket go up. I didn't know it was a rocket, but Lieutenant Gerhardt did. I didn't actually see the rocket hit the jet, but I saw the jet twist in the air, hesitate for a long moment, and then start down. "There's a chute," Monaco spotted it first. We watched the parachute come down slowly, and the plane streak away. We couldn't figure out what had happened with the plane. Then a heavy stream of smoke came from it, and it disappeared. Sergeant Simpson got on the radio to spot the parachute, but he said it was already on the waves. All the time we were showing the movies, the civilians were talking to the villagers. The woman let some people play with the kid. I got near enough to her to hear her talking Vietnamese. When it was time to leave, a chopper took the civilians someplace. They thanked us and told us we were doing a good job. They weren't the kind of people that had to be in Vietnam. I wondered just what kind of people they were. Pee-wee got a letter. I hoped it was from his woman, but it wasn't.
"Say, Perry, what's your mama's name?"
"I don't play that mama stuff, Pee-wee," I said.
"No, I ain't running no dozens, man," Pee-wee said. "I just want to know her name."
"Mabel."
"What's my name?"
"If you don't know, I'm not telling you," I said.
"My name is Pee-wee Gates," Pee-wee said. "And what is the name on this letter?"
I looked at the letter. It had his name on it, but it was from Mama.
"How come my mother is sending you a letter?" I asked. "You must have told her about me."
"Yeah, I did. Open it up."
"Don't be telling me when to open my mail," Pee-wee said.
Pee-wee didn't open the letter all day. I tried to figure out what Mama would have to say to Pee-wee. I had written to her and told her that Lieutenant Carroll had died. Maybe that worried her. Maybe I shouldn't have told her that. People back home didn't want to know about the war. I knew that. But Mama was used to hard times. I thought it would be okay to tell her. Usually, Pee-wee and I went to chow together. But I told him I wasn't hungry. When he went, I looked under his bunk and took Mama's letter out.
"Dear Pee-wee, Richard has told me all about you, and you sound like a very fine boy. I wish you all the luck in the world and hope you get the chance to go home to your family. I do not know why Richard went into the army, because he did not seem to be the type. Only I think he was not happy at home. If something happens to him, please tell him that I love him very much. You seem to be his friend, and he will believe you. You can write to me if you want to. Mabel Perry."
It made me sad that Mama had written to Pee-wee to say that she loved me. She hadn't even told me that when I was leaving. I put the letter back and wrote to Mama. I told her that I loved her very much and missed her very much. I had always had a small war with Mama. I was always the bright one, and she always the one that didn't understand what I needed. Now all I could think of was how much I needed her. Wallowick got a rash on the inside of his thigh, his back, and on the inside of his arms. It looked terrible. Everybody took a look at it and offered their opinion on what it might be. Lieutenant Gerhardt came into our hooch and saw it and asked Wallowick if he had been having intimate relations with anything with a reptilian background.
"Like a snake or a lizard?"
Gerhardt said with a big smile on his face.
"Go fuck yourself," Wallowick said.
Gerhard didn't like Wallowick saying that. You could see it all over his face. But he didn't say anything. Late that night, we watched some television. Security was getting tighter, and we had to cover the windows of the hooch the television was in, which made it just about too hot to watch the thing. We watched Gunsmoke and then a Christmas show. I forgot it was almost Christmas. It got me a little sad, and I was just about to go back to our hooch when all of a sudden, there we were on television. It was the time we had gone out with the television crew.
"There I go," Pee-wee said. "You know, I sure don't look like no damn soldier."
"What you look like is a VC," Monocle said.
I watched the film with the others. They made little comments about how they had felt walking that day, and how they were surprised at how the cameras made us look.
"Where am I?"
I didn't see myself.
"There you go, behind me."
I looked older than I thought I did in real life. Older and sloppier. The pictures also made it look as if the photographers were leading the patrol. But what the squad wasn't talking about was the guy walking behind Wallowick. Lieutenant Carroll turned back to make sure we had kept our distances. He seemed for a moment to look directly into the camera. His eyes were quiet, serious, as they always were. And then, as he had to, he turned away from us. Chapter 12.
"I think you should major in math," Pee-wee said.
Wallowick had a catalog from the college he wanted to go to when he got back to the world, and Pee-wee was telling him what to take.
"I'm no good in math," Wallowick said. "I think I'll take music or something like that. Something easy."
"Why don't you go to the University of Chicago?" Brunner said. "That's got a good reputation. Who ever heard of Knox College?"
"That sound like that school of hard knocks I've been hearing about," Pee-wee said. "Knox is good, and it's in my hometown,"
Wallowick said.
"My cousin went there."
"They got any brothers going to that school?" I asked.
"The first colored senator went to Knox," Wallowick said. "The whole town has a good history with helping colors and stuff like that. The Underground Railroad used to go through Galesburg."
"You study math like I told you," Pee-wee said in a gruff voice. "Then I let you come to Chicago and be a big-time numbers man."
"Wallowick would rather stay over here than go to Chicago,"
Sergeant Simpson chimed in.
"He figured he'd stay over here, he'll be safer."
"What else you got in the mail?" Monocle asked.
"A newspaper," Wallowick said.
"Only thing in it is the stuff about guys burning their draft cards."
"Faggots and commies," Brunner said.
"Anybody who wouldn't stand up for their country is either a faggot or a commie."
"They're doing what they think is right," Monocle said.
"Maybe they are right. Who knows?"
"That's why we got 4- and 5-man squads," Brunner said. "Because those jerks are home smoking dope and burning their draft cards. You get blown away because you don't have a full squad. You can thank those creeps."
"I almost went to Canada when I got notice to go down to register," Bruce said.
"Yeah, but then you got it together," Brunner said.
"No, man, I didn't have the nerve."
Bruce had a sheepish grin on his face. A rat scurried up the side of the hooch, jumped onto Wallowick's bunk, and stopped right in the middle of it. We had put some poison around, and we figured he must have been dying. It was about 7 to 8 inches long and bloated up.
"Brunner, get your piece," Sergeant Simpson said.
Brunner had a .22 air rifle. He got it, kneeled down, and shot the rat. It died right on Wallowick's bunk, and Wallowick got pissed off. He left the hooch and told Brunner he had better have his bunk cleaned up before he got back. The rest of us got up and split and left Brunner and the rat in the hooch. What Brew had said about not having the nerve to go to Canada shook me. Here he was in Nam, getting shot at every day, afraid of every noise, every step,
and yet he had been afraid of going to Canada. It shook me because I knew what he meant. Sometimes standing alone seemed to be the hardest thing in the world to do, even when being in the crowd meant you could be killed. We got hit by a rocket attack that night. It came on us all of a sudden. I woke up screaming. The sounds of the explosions rattled through the hooches, and we couldn't tell where the rockets were hitting. I grabbed my helmet and rifle and ran for the bunker. The noise messed me up. I jumped with every explosion. I trembled as the ground shook around me.
"Look for sappers! Look for sappers!"
Sergeant Simpson was calling out for us to look out for sappers, the Vietnamese suicide squads. He had 62 days to go, and he was trying to stay alive.
"Somebody send up a flare!"
Monaco.
"I'm going to get some,"
Pee-wee. The squad had settled down. I was still shaking. I heard somebody screaming for a medic. The flare went up and there was some firing, but we didn't see any sappers. The rocket stopped. The flares died down. They put out the fires. The night had us again. Captain Stewart came around to check for casualties. He started talking about how we had to be more aggressive, how we had to go out to get the VC.
"We gotta keep them up a few nights," he said.
He patted Sergeant Simpson on the shoulder. When he left, I could see that Sergeant Simpson didn't look good.
"You okay, Sarge?" I asked.
"That man bucking for Major real bad," he said. "He gonna get somebody killed before he makes it."
I couldn't sleep and sat outside in the bunker trying to catch a little breeze. Johnson was there too.
"This reminds me of a Harlem night," I said. "Sometimes the little apartment we lived in would be so hot you couldn't sleep for days."
"Wish I was any place I could call home," Johnson said.
"Wherever it is, I'll think more of it the next time I get there," I said.
"Yeah."
He looked away.
"What you think about them protesters?"
I was surprised at the question. I looked up and saw that he was leaning back against the sandbags. I could just see his silhouette, helmet pushed back, rifle across his lap. "I don't know," I said.
"You think much about why you were going to fight before you came in?"
"Uh-uh. You?"
"No. But I'm thinking a lot about it now."
"'Cause they shooting at your ass?"
"Sounds like a good enough reason to be thinking about it," I said.
"You trying to figure out who the good guys, huh?"
Johnson spoke slowly.
"So what you come up with?"
"I guess somebody back home knows what they're doing," I said. "What it means and everything. You talk about communists, stuff like that, and it doesn't mean much when you're in school. Then when you get over here, the only thing they're talking about is keeping your ass in one piece."
"Vietnam don't mean nothing, man," Johnson said. "We could do the same thing someplace else. We just over here killing people to let everybody know we gonna do it if it gotta be done."
"That might be a good reason to be over here," I said.
"That's for people like you to mess with," Johnson said.
"I don't know about that."
"Then why you messing with it?"
When I turned in, Pee-wee was still up. He told me he had an idea. He was going to spray the netting with this new repellent we got. I got into my bunk and pulled the mosquito netting around it, and then Pee-wee sprayed the netting, which was supposed to be his good idea.
"Yo, Pee-wee, I can't breathe in here," I said.
"I wondered if that was going to be a problem,"
Pee-wee said.
I fell asleep thinking about what Johnson had said. Maybe the time had passed,
when anybody could be a good guy.
Chapter 13. December 22nd, 1967. 3 days before Christmas, and only 10 days left in the whole year. Me and Pee-wee spent all day talking about whether we should try to have sex with a Vietnamese girl before we got back to the States. He figured it might be our only chance to have sex with a foreign woman. "Suppose we catch something," I said.
"That's what combat is all about,"
he said, looking in the mirror he had nailed on a pole at the end of his bunk.
"Taking chances."
"How about Wallowick?" I asked.
"He didn't mess with no women,"
Pee-wee said.
"He just got the nom right."
That was true. Wallowick had been sent to the 312th to get his rash treated. Sergeant Simpson said that it usually took a week to clear up a real mean rash. By that time, according to the word going around, the war was going to be over. Captain Stewart said that the war wasn't over yet, and for us not to get too relaxed. "We can spend the last weeks of the war kicking a little ass and letting them know who the hell we were," he said. The way the story was going around was that the Vietnamese had agreed to a truce for their New Year's celebration, which they called Tet. Then the truce would be just extended while the talks went on, and we would all go home. Captain Stewart seemed disappointed. I wrote Mama telling her that I expected to be home around January or February. I didn't believe all the stories, but I did believe Jamal. Jamal said that all of the South Vietnamese officers were going home for the holidays.
"And they should know,"
he said, looking like a serious bullfrog. Then some other stuff started coming down the line. There was a lot of Kong activity, and the special forces guys in Cambodia were spotting convoys.
"Them greenies just don't want to have a truce,"
Sergeant Simpson said.
"If they ain't got them a good war, they don't know what to do with themselves."
Back home, the world seemed to be splitting up between people who wanted to make love and people who wanted to tear the cities down. A lot of it was blacks against whites, and we didn't talk about that too much, but we felt it. Over the summer, a kid in Harlem had been killed by a white police sergeant, and there had been some riots. I told Mama in a letter to tell Kenny to be careful. Sometimes he had a fresh mouth, and I didn't want him hurt. Kenny was all Mama had left. She had me, in a way, but not in any real way. Kenny loved her straight up and down. He didn't see any faults in her. I loved her, too, but not like Kenny. When you're young, the way Kenny was, you didn't ask much of people. Christmas. Depression. We had roast beef, mashed potatoes, peas and carrots, carrot cake, and candy canes. They were supposed to send in a movie called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Sidney Poitier, but when they opened the cans, they found the movie with Julie Andrews that we had already seen.
"That other movie don't sound like much anyway," Monaco said. "Some black dude coming to dinner." "Maybe they were going to have fried chicken, and they were afraid he was going to eat too much,"
Brunner said.
"Maybe they thought your mama was gonna eat too much, too,"
Pee-wee said. That ended that conversation. Word came in that the Marines were catching hell all over the place. Some old-timers said that a pissload of Marines were trapped up in the hills of Quezon. The fighting was picking up. Captain Stewart was still saying that the VC were trying to get into place in time for the Tet holiday.
"The only trouble is..."
Lieutenant Gerhardt sat on an ammo box with his feet up on Brunner's bed.
"What they're seeing most of is the NVA, not the VC."
"The NVA ain't nothing but the VC with their pajamas off,"
Pee-wee said.
"Bullshit."
Gerhardt turned and looked toward Pee-wee with his eyes half closed as if he were asleep.
"The NVA get up to a year of training before they even get to the South. The VC are guerrillas. The NVA is their regular army."
"It don't mean shit to me,"
Pee-wee said.
"We're talking about regiment-sized units,"
Gerhardt went on.
"They finally figured out they can't whip us with this little guerrilla action."
"Hey, man,"
Monaco sat up.
They can't whip us with nothing they got.
I looked up to see if Monaco was kidding. He wasn't. But he talked about it like it was a volleyball game or something. The sounds of fighting, the far-off booming of the artillery, the hollow bass drum sound of explosions echoing off the mountains became a constant thing. Before, it had been an occasional crackle of gunfire, the steady rhythms of 50-caliber machine guns with the 60s answering in short riffs. Sometimes, just after the gut-shaking boom of a jet, you could see the bombs arc down and, if the wind was just right, the sound would be somewhere in between thunder and a cymbal clash. Pee-wee said that it sounded like a Southside jazz club when the brothers were right. A death blues for Mr. Kong. The noises had always scared me. I had gone through basic training just fine until the end when we had to go under live fire. The noises shook you, made you want to stop and hide. Now it was different. Now the sound swelled in my consciousness like a dull headache. It kept coming and coming, day and night. Sometimes I felt as if the sounds were inside me somehow. And there were times, I never wanted to mention them to anyone else, that I heard the sounds at night when it was very quiet, and no one else heard them. I was ready for the truce. Stars and Stripes talked about peace feelers in Paris. Where I was, it was raining. It rained almost every day. The ruts filled with water. There wasn't any place to dry out. We waited and listened to the stories coming in. They weren't good. When the Tet started, we were put on alert. We kept hearing about truce violations. They kept talking about the body counts we picked up, but the ones they gave at the end of the reports, our own KIAs killed in action, were climbing too. All of First Corps went on alert as we found out that all the major cities were being hit, all the way from Saigon North to the DMZ. Interdiction Patrol. That's what they called it, but it sounded like a plain ambush to us. We were being separated from the rest of the outfit, which was supposed to be operating further north above Phuoc Ha. Meanwhile, our squad was supposed to stop nighttime traffic between two hamlets. TT contact, Gearhart said, using the Vietnamese phrase for little. All light stuff. Sergeant Simpson said that because of Gearhart's training, they were using our squad on long-range reconnaissance. We were packing up to go when Jamal came by. He told us that Captain Stewart had volunteered us to replace a reconnaissance team that had been wiped out. Wallowick came back just in time for the patrol. He looked okay. The rash was gone. When he found out that we were going on patrol, he got really upset. He almost spooked the whole squad. Come on, man, this squad is the best, Monaco said. Everything within 10 kilometers of Tam Kai belongs to us. Yeah. Wallowick was scared. He had always been kind of even, but being away for a little while must have got to him. We got 6 new brothers in the platoon, and 2 were assigned to our squad. One was from the south, a brother named Nate Turner, and the other one, Darren Lewis, was from the Bronx. I couldn't remember exactly where, even though he told me twice. We went in a chopper with some First Cav guys who were going up to Quang Nam province. The choppers dropped us off first. We went east through a fairly dense stretch of forest and then swung back west until we hit our coordinates. Sergeant Simpson said that we would be picked up in a different zone. He acted worried. It was our first patrol with Gearhart. Simpson told me and Monaco to keep our eyes on Gearhart.
Just so he don't get me killed, he said.
He had 22 days left. This ambush patrol was different than the first one we had been on near the cemetery. This was along a small road going just east of some pretty high hills. We were to take one stretch of the road, and some South Vietnamese regulars, ARVN, were to be up a little way from us. When we got to the ambush site, Sergeant Simpson didn't like it. The road itself was small and ran along a rice paddy. There were dikes leading from the road, but they didn't look too firm. The other side of the road was a lightly wooded area.
That sucker's probably mined, Sergeant Simpson said. We gotta go down to the end of the paddy and check that out.
We'll set up here, Sergeant,
Lieutenant Gearhart's voice stiffened.
We ain't got no cover here, sir,
Sergeant Simpson looked at Gearhart.
There's cover there, Gearhart said.
He pointed to a small trench along the side of the paddy. There were thin bushes next to it, nothing that would stop a bullet.
We'll put sandbags behind the bushes.
You're gonna get some people killed over here.
Sergeant, I know what I'm doing.
Gearhart took a step toward Simpson.
Now deploy the men.
For a moment, the two men stood looking at each other. Then Sergeant Simpson turned away. I didn't like it. I knew Simpson. I didn't know Gearhart yet. Simpson got Monaco and took him down the paddy and placed him. Then he came back and got me and Pee-wee.
Pee-wee, you and Perry be our rear security. Monaco got the other end. First noise you hear, light it up. We ain't waiting for nothing to get into no damn killing zone, because I don't want it to be my ass that gets killed out here tonight.
Gearhart came up with a diagram, a little picture of the place we were in. We were to set up an L just off the road. The short end of the L was the front. Monaco and Lobo had that. The rest of the squad, except me and Pee-wee, were on the long side of the L, which paralleled the road. Me and Pee-wee were off to the rear of the squad line to watch in case the Kongs came through the paddies behind the squad.
Set your claymores out near that paddy dike, Gearhart said to me.
The claymores sent fragments of steel in whatever direction you pointed them. They could be set off from a distance.
You see a patrol, you let them into the zone until their rear man gets on a line with that tree over there. You understand that?
Suppose it's more than a patrol, Pee-wee said. By the time their rear man gets lined up with that tree, you could have 100 of them out there.
That's okay, Gearhart said. If it's that large a unit, we'll just open up on their rear and get as many casualties as possible. That'll make them back off until we can retreat. Charlie isn't the only one that can play guerrilla games out here.
He clicked his tongue at Pee-wee and left.
What the fuck does that mean?
Pee-wee looked at me. I guess he means we'll hit and run, I guess.
No, man, what he's sucking his tongue at me for?
Pee-wee's eyes narrowed.
That man definitely need his ass kicked.
I hope we get back to base to kick it, I said. If somebody spotted us out here, we got a world of trouble. Or if it rains.
Rain don't bother me,
Pee-wee said.
If it starts raining again, how you gonna see who's lined up with what damn tree?
I'm doing what Sarge said, Pee-wee said.
If I see a damn dog out here, I'm blasting away.
Johnson was in the center of the squad with the 60. Brunner had the radio, and the rest of the squad were to one side or the other. I had the claymores and 36 grenades. The claymores were the baddest things going. They could be aimed to cover a target area and wasted anything within 60 meters in front of them.
Pee-wee, you got your switchblade?
Damn straight, came the quick answer.
Why do you always carry that thing?
Case this war gets serious, Pee-wee said.
Perry, you put out the claymores?
Wallowick's voice.
Damn, I forgot them. Cover me.
I couldn't believe I hadn't put out the claymores. I started off as quickly as I could, keeping a low profile. The moon seemed to float in a curtain of fog over the field. I was praying for rain. I went out and started putting in the first claymore. There was nothing to attach a tripwire to that looked like it would cover anything. Maybe I could have figured out something if I had stayed out a little longer, but I heard a double click coming from Pee-wee's direction. I set the mine for remote detonation and got back to Pee-wee as soon as I could.
What's up? I whispered. I just heard two clicks from somebody, so I passed them on,
Pee-wee said. Two clicks were our signal on the first go-round. Then it would be one click, and then one and two. I made sure the grenade launcher was ready.
Psst!
Lobo was crawling toward us.
What's up?
Gearhart wants to know if you set the claymores for remote.
Yeah. He saw me on the scope?
You could see almost as well with the starlight scope at night as you could see in the daylight.
Yeah, Pee-wee said. He got Brunner on the remote.
It got dark quickly. I was glad for the darkness and afraid of it. Whatever was terrible, I thought about. Suppose I was hit and they didn't notice it in the darkness. No, Pee-wee would notice it. I just knew he would. Pee-wee or Monaco. Brew came down the line and checked everybody. The wet ground soon had my fatigue soaked. I was getting cold. I wondered if they had actually started sending outfits home. I thought about Hawaii. The war was 1,000 miles away. We could hear its rumbling, but all we were doing was waiting for the word to get back to the base. It wasn't our war, I told myself. Not tonight. There was a faint odor that I recognized. Rotting bamboo. They used it along the paddy dikes for footing. I tried to think of something to think about. I didn't want to think about Mama. If I thought about her, I would get too involved. Same thing with Kenny. Same thing with Lieutenant Carroll. What to think about? Faye Jackson. Light-skinned, sweet-voiced girl from the Virgin Islands. I think I could have had sex with her before I left. You couldn't tell about the girls from the Virgin Islands. I knew three. Faye and her sister and another girl named Darlene. They all swung their hips when they walked and filled my head with fantasies. I decided to have a fantasy about Faye.
Floop!
Somebody in the squad set off a flare. We were all exposed. For a moment, we all watched it in fascination. Then Monaco started yelling.
Right side, blow the mines! No, no!
Sergeant Simpson jumped up and started waving his hands. I looked at where I had put the claymores and saw a figure moving away from it.
He turned it!
The claymore went off, and we all hit the dirt. I could hear bullets whining by me. I stuck my head up and saw a tracer come at me. I dug down again. Pee-wee was firing. I could hear the 60. I stuck my head up again and the tracers kept coming at me. I dug down again. I couldn't believe I wasn't hit. Pee-wee took the launcher from me and was firing it, snatching grenades from my rucksack and off my suspenders. I shook my head trying to clear it. I put my head up again and the tracers were headed toward the center of the squad, but they were high. They had looked like they were coming toward me, but they were high. There were dozens of muzzle blasts, more than I had ever seen before. It looked like a whole company. We were outnumbered. My stomach cramped and my mouth went dry. I got Pee-wee's 16 and started firing. Pee-wee had his pistol out. He let off a shot near my head that burned my ear and made my whole head ring. We fired and fired. I couldn't see a thing except an occasional muzzle blast, and they seemed to be moving away.
Move it out! Move it out!
Sergeant Simpson was crawling along the ground. We started crawling after him.
Go through the paddy,
Lieutenant Gearhart said hoarsely.
Hell no,
Sergeant Simpson answered. We followed Sergeant Simpson until we hit the wood line. He took the starlight from Gearhart and looked back toward the paddies. Then he signaled us to follow him. It was a good 20 minutes to the pickup zone if we were fast. We were fast. Brunner called in the pickup chopper and we waited and prayed. We didn't hear anything. Then we heard small arms fire to our left.
They hearing noises in the dark,
Sergeant Simpson said. We waited. It started to rain. I thanked God for the rain. The moon drifted in and out of the clouds. I thought that maybe the Kongs wouldn't look for us. The rain dripped down from the branches above us. I was cold. My knee ached. I was scared. A half hour passed and no chopper. We heard mortar rounds going off. They seemed close. We all held our breaths, but they landed off from us. The Kongs didn't know where we were. They were throwing mortars into the field behind us. Voices.
Vietnamese. I couldn't tell how many or where they came from. I had taped some of the grenades to my belt. Now I pulled some of the tape off and put it over my tags, sticking them to my chest.
"Where's the fucking chopper?"
Monica whispered.
"Maybe the rain's too hard,"
Lobel said. I cursed the rain. Why the hell did it have to rain? The voices were closer. We were bunched, too scared to move, to spread out. A noise to the right. We tried pressing against the trees, keeping our heads down. The moon came out partially. It was One Kong. He had his piece by his side. He looked around, then put it down near a tree. He couldn't have been more than the distance from home plate to the pitcher's mound. Then he took his pants down and squatted. Lieutenant Gearhart stood and started toward the Kong. Monocle raised his rifle to cover Gearhart. For a few seconds, I couldn't see Gearhart at all. Then I saw him just as the Kong saw him, but it was too late. Gearhart was on him. Monocle went toward them. By the time he got there, it was all over. Gearhart had wasted the Kong. The chopper. We heard it, but we couldn't see it.
"Sweet mother, Density 1.
Brunner spoke into the phone.
"Can you spot yellow?"
Brunner got an affirmative answer, and Brew threw a yellow signal flare toward the clearing in front of us. It flared up briefly and died, but the chopper had seen it. It came down quickly, and we started for it.
"Come on!"
Pee-wee was on first with Monocle on his back. There was firing behind us. They hadn't spotted us yet. I got on the chopper and twisted to help the next guy on. It was Wallowick. Wallowick's piece went off and ricocheted around the inside of the chopper and got one of the crew.
"Asshole!"
The pilot kicked Wallowick as Brew and Johnson got on. There was a scream. Not just a scream, but a sound that was like something awful and almost inhuman.
"Man down!"
The chopper machine guns raked the wood line.
"Lights!"
Simpson and Gearhart were going back. Monaco was out the door and I followed him. The chopper's guns were sweeping everything and I ran in a crouched position. The lights went on and I saw Gearhart and Simpson helping one of the new guys. Simpson waved at the chopper and the lights went off. We got back into the chopper and everybody grabbed something and held on tight as it pulled away.
"Who set the first flare off?"
Monaco asked.
"We got somebody here working for Charlie?"
"It just... I made a mistake," Gearhart said.
"Don't be making no more mistakes, man, because I'll frag your ass in a hot damn minute."
Monaco spat on the ground.
"Where's the medic? Where the medic?"
Sergeant Simpson's voice was high and frantic.
"Who the medic?"
"You just shot the fucking medic,"
the door gunner said.
"I'm okay."
The medic was a long shadow in the dark interior of the chopper. I could just see flashes of his face as he started examining the wounded man. A moment later, a red light came on. The medic looked deathly white with dark shadows under his eyes. The wounded man screamed for a while, then begged for a while, then went back to screaming. We turned away from him, tried to shut him out of our minds. The medic fumbled briefly with the wounded man's fatigues, then cut them away from his chest. It was Turner, the new guy from the south. His eyes were wild and his chest heaving. He started to vomit and clutch at the arms of the medic. The medic pushed his hands away. He sprinkled some powder on the wound and taped a square bandage to his chest. He patted him on the shoulder and gave him the thumbs up sign.
"Anybody else hit?"
He closed the fatigues.
"My arm's hurt."
The other new guy. The medic put a flashlight on the arm. It was swollen, probably broken. He looked at the guy's eyes, then put the flashlight out.
"You'll be okay,"
he said. Then he slumped backward.
"You okay, Smitty?"
The door gunner asked him.
"Light shit, man,"
he said. By the time we got to the camp, Turner was dead. We got some guys to first aid the medic and the other new guy,
and then the chopper took them away.
"We gotta kick your lieutenant's ass,"
Pee-wee said when Simpson came into the hooch later.
"We'll see about him,"
Simpson said.
"But we got something else to deal with, too. When that flare went up, Perry, you know what I seen?"
"What?"
"I seen with my own two eyes the Charlie run up to that claymore you set, turn it around, and run before Monaco got him."
"Yeah?"
"Well, if he turned it around and it went off, and it didn't get none of us, how did you have the damn thing facing to begin with?"
"Oh, shit." Chapter 14. What had happened? The squad had been in a firefight, and we had been almost overrun. For the first time since I reached Nam, we had been in the middle of it. Turner had been killed. And not by some faceless enemy, some random shot from far away, but by an enemy I could see and hear. And what about me? I had stood trembling in fear and waiting, and had run in near panic for the choppers and hoped and prayed for a few minutes more of life. The war was not a long way from where we were. We were in the middle of it, and it was deeply within us. We didn't talk about the wounded man or about Turner, who had died. I think we were glad that we hadn't known him better. Maybe even that if somebody had to die from the squad, it was better that it was a new guy. It was always better that it was someone else.
"Hey, everybody, listen to this."
Monaco was in his shorts, sitting on his bed with the letter in his lap.
"Dear Sonny, I have been thinking more and more about you every day. I know that you are a long way away and have a lot on your mind and everything. But, Sonny, I wanted to ask you this. Will you marry me when you get home? Please think about it a lot, as I think you and I would make a nice couple. I got the idea while I was down at the mall on Route 440 yesterday. If you don't think you want to marry me, please don't put it in a letter. Just don't say anything and I will know. Yours, Julie."
"She pregnant?" Pee-wee asked.
"No, she just loves me, man,"
Monaco said.
"This chick has been in love with me since before I even knew what love was." "You gonna marry her?"
Wallowick asked.
"I don't know. What do you guys think?"
"What's she look like?"
Pee-wee asked.
"She's 5'2", maybe 5'3",
Monaco said.
"Kinda fine, but she ain't really the foxy type, you know what I mean? She's an athlete, too. She plays softball for St. Dominic's in Jersey City."
"We got a vote on it?" Johnson said. "I vote against it."
"Why?"
Monaco looked over at where Johnson was cleaning his machine gun.
"She a nice girl?"
"Yeah."
"Then why she want to marry you?"
Johnson ran the swab through the barrel of his piece.
"You ain't even got no job."
"I'll get a job when I get home,"
Monaco said.
"You see these hands? These hands can do anything in the damn world. I can make stuff, I can fix stuff, I can do anything. Maybe I'll even be a cop or a fireman, something like that."
"What's she do?"
Johnson asked.
"She got a good job,"
Monaco said.
"She works for Western Electric."
"I vote for the marriage," Pee-wee said.
"Marry her,"
Brunner said.
"Monaco, do you love this girl?" Bruce said.
"Yeah," Monaco said. "I love the shit out of her."
"You go to the same church?"
"Yeah."
"Then Reverend Brew pronounces y'all man and wife,"
Pee-wee said.
"I think you should marry her."
Brew spoke for himself, but he looked like he didn't mind Pee-wee calling him Reverend Brew. The final vote was 5-2 in favor of Monaco marrying the girl. Wallowick didn't think we should vote at all, that it was a sacred decision. Johnson thought that Monaco should get a job first before he made plans to marry her, and Lobo said that he should wait until he got back to the world before he made a decision.
"You gotta see her again," Lobo said. "I can't even think of seeing my father again and being the same guy I was when I left home.
And if I'm not the same guy, he's not the same either.
He gotta marry her, Pee-wee said. We done voted on it now.
Okay, you guys are all invited to the wedding. I'll plan it so that the wedding will be after the last guy in the squad leaves Nam.
How about me? Johnson asked. You inviting me too?
Yeah, all of us.
We started talking about weddings. Wallowick said he hated weddings and funerals because all of his relatives got together and fought.
First they dance and hug for about a half an hour, Wallowick said. Then they drink for 2 hours. Then they fight.
That's because they white, Pee-wee said. If they was black, they could slip in some signifying along with the laughing and dancing and then skip right to the fighting before the drinking even started.
Jamal came over from HQ and said that Captain Stewart wanted to see me.
About my profile?
What profile?
I'm not supposed to wear boots, I said. I don't know nothing about no profile, Jamal said. I think it's about Gearhart.
I went over to HQ Hut, and Captain Stewart was watching Phil Silvers on television.
You want to tell me what happened last night? He asked.
About what?
Your patrol lost 2 men.
He was drinking from a cup. I was about 4 feet away, but I could still smell it was booze.
One killed, one wounded.
We were waiting for the chopper and...
Medevac? You were waiting for a medevac?
No, sir, we hadn't been hit yet, I said. We were hoping to get away without being hit.
Lieutenant Gearhart mess up.
He shot off a flare. We got exposed, I said. But I think they knew we were there.
You're a good man, Perry, he said. Why don't you see what you can do with this letter? Give it back to me before it's sent.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you something else, too. How many of the enemy do you think there were?
Seemed like the place was crawling with them, sir.
And you guys laid down a pretty good line of fire?
Best we could.
How many you think we got? He asked. I know you can't be sure. Just give me a number.
I didn't know what to say. A picture of the Paddies came into my mind.
20? 30?
Maybe not that many, sir.
Maybe, but it could have been.
It could have been, sir.
Good enough. Captain Stewart nodded. See what you can do with that letter.
I read the letter. It was Lieutenant Gearhart to Turner's folks. It said that it was his fault that their son was dead and he was sorry. There was a lot of pain in the letter. It said that Turner was hit in the back after our position had been exposed to the enemy. I rewrote the letter. I said that Turner was fighting off the enemy, trying to let the rest of us escape, when he was killed. Gearhart was in the mess hall, slumped over a cup of coffee, when I found him and showed him the letter. He read it slowly and shook his head.
Captain Stewart told me to write it, I said.
If I hadn't set off that damn flare.
His voice trailed off.
He still might have got it, I said.
You can't tell.
You know, I never thought much about black people before I got into the army. I didn't think I was prejudiced or anything. I just didn't think much about black people.
Well, we're here, I said.
I think I should let his parents know what happened, Gearhart said. I don't want to be left off the hook.
The letter I wrote, I said, is going to sit better with his family. You might feel bad, like you need to get something off your chest. But don't drop it on his folks. It's going to be hard enough just having him dead. He looked at me, then pushed the letter across the table.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
I wanted to be pissed at him. I wanted to think that he was crap because of what he said about black people. But the only thing I could think about was that I was glad it was Turner and not me. It wasn't what I wanted to feel, or what I thought I was supposed to feel. Jamal came by and showed me the body count figures. Stewart had listed 28 of the enemy as killed. We got the word that the first hamlet we had worked on the pacification patrol was being harassed by the VC. A Major Leff was giving us the rundown about what was going on. He seemed to know what he was talking about.
"We've seen the infiltration over the last 2 months or so," he said. "We thought it was in response to the peace talks. They've been stalling in the talks, and the thinking was that they wanted to get into a favorable position before the talks get underway so that they can claim more territory than they actually had. But now we're not sure. Intelligence reports a lot of movement just north of the DMZ and in Cambodia and Laos. The harassment of the hamlets and villages is part of the whole movement. If they can terrorize the villages, then they can create a hostile atmosphere in them for us. You have to remember that there's as much of a psychological war going on over here as there is a physical war. I have the feeling that we could win the real war and still lose the psychological war. What I want from you men is as much vigilance as possible until the situation is clearer. Your officers have all been briefed, but it's up to you guys to do the job. God be with each and every one of you."
An intelligence report said that our village was going to be hit by the VC at 1800 hours the next day. 1800 hours was a hell of a time. It would still be daylight, and if they showed up in the daylight, they would be demonstrating that they weren't afraid of us, that we couldn't protect the village. Captain Stewart sent all of Alpha Company to the village. We were supposed to link up with a company from the 173rd Airborne. They had the 173rd hopping all over the place, and they were really doing a job from what we heard. They were supposed to go in first and secure the village, and then we were to protect it overnight or until it was decided that the VC in the area weren't a threat.
"This mess sounds good," Sergeant Simpson said. "We sit in the village until the truce, and maybe we'd be sitting out the rest of the damn war."
Gearhart was quiet. Sergeant Simpson, who had been bumped up to top sergeant, was more or less leading the whole platoon. As soon as I heard the sound of the chopper engines, I had to pee. I found a tree and peed, and then went toward our chopper. Wallowick was already in the door of the Huey and gave me a hand up. My stomach was tight as I found a spot to squat.
"Get them weapons on safe,"
Simpson called out. Gearhart was checking gear. He had Pee-wee carrying a shotgun for the first time. Pee-wee, Wallowick, Sergeant Simpson, and Brunner were opposite me. Brew, Monaco, Johnson, Lobo, and Gearhart were on my side. We started off with the other choppers. I was scared again. Wasn't there ever going to be a time when I wasn't scared? Monaco was reading the letter from his girl.
"You know," he said, "it takes balls for a chick to propose to a guy."
Yeah. I wondered if anybody else had the feeling of being scared. I looked over at Pee-wee. He was looking at a manual that had been on the floor of the Huey. The artillery fire was more frightening now. Puffs of smoke around us meant that they were shooting at the chopper. If they hit us while we were in the air, we didn't have a chance. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." I thought the words. Would God think I was a hypocrite, praying every time I was scared? A guy from the chopper crew turned, looked at us, and asked who Gearhart was. Gearhart raised his hand, and the chopper guy handed him the headset. We all watched Gearhart, trying to figure out what was being said, trying to read his face, his gestures. He nodded once. Again. He handed back the headset.
We're securing the village instead of the 173rd, he said.
Where the hell's the 173rd?
Simpson asked. Gearhart shrugged. Sergeant Simpson wiped his palm on his pants leg. I had heard him say to Pee-wee that Stewart had asked him to extend. He had less than 2 weeks left in Nam. The chopper stopped in midair, then made a violent maneuver. I thought we were hit. I looked up at the chopper crew,